All right, well, thank you very much, and thanks for the invitation. It's lovely to be here and to see so many people here today, including some linguists, I see, so well done. So as you can see, I've chosen for my topic today one of the most canonical utterances in Western philosophy. I think, therefore I am. And even in its Latin version, cogito ergo sum, it has attained that canonical status. It is so well known, but it's got its own abbreviation, the cogito. But it was first written in French in 1637 in the Discours de la méthode, or Discourse on Method, as je pense, donc je suis. And Descartes was very explicit about the fact that he was writing in French, first of all, so that he could attract a wide audience. So Latin was the language of scholarship, but he wanted anybody to be able to access his work, including people, and most especially women, who had not learned Latin at school. So he chose French. And in whatever language you read it, this is a formulation that is pithy, it's memorable, and it has become a soundbite. And it's in the nature of a soundbite to be taken out of context or put in a headline, just as I have done today. So what I'm going to be trying to do for the remainder of this talk is put it back in context, which I think is quite an interesting enterprise, so I hope to convey some of that interest to you today. But first of all, I want to tackle head-on a particular fact about the cogito, as it is in my experience received, which is that it sounds kind of ridiculous. I mean, I think, therefore I am. It's very easily parodied. When I was preparing this talk, I thought to myself, well, I have seen in the past various Descartes cartoons, you know, so I immediately Googled these, as you do, because you know, that's what you pay me for. And I got something like 184,000 hits. I think, therefore I am, makes it sound like if one suddenly stopped thinking, then one is going to disappear into a puff of smoke. Hence, this. I think, therefore I am, sounds ridiculous in its emphasis on the individual thinker, the unsupported genius alone in his room. I mean, what about mothers and fathers and teachers and lovers, not to mention all the complex interactions with other people which go to make up a life. Hence, this. Sorry, guys, I can't see. So this is the slogan, it's all very well for you, but what about me? I think, therefore I am, seemingly makes existence dependent on the mind. So where, you may very justifiably be asking, is the human body in all this? Descartes makes a move to separate off mind and body. And this is what's known as Cartesian dualism, or the mind-body split. But of course, one only has to take the case study of, vodka, to point out that what one does to the body affects the mind. And when I was discussing Cartesian dualism with Edward Wilson Lee, when he initially invited me to give this talk, he suggested that I engage in some kind of audience participation at this point. Shots of vodka to better prove this point, but anyway, I think we all get the point. And Descartes himself does actually acknowledge the basic common sense everyday interaction of mind and body too. So how does that work when I think, therefore I am? Now, people often ask me if I'm defending Descartes, and I never really know what to say to this, because I don't see my role or my training in that kind of way. I mean, my background is in literary criticism, by the way, so perhaps if I were in philosophy, I'd be more inclined to defend or condemn. But what I am interested in is, as I say, context, and I've got this research project on the go at the moment called Descartes' Fictions, and I'm trying to set his work in the context of the poetic theory of the time, contemporary debates about how, for example, theatre works, how theatre makes you think. So I might say a little bit more about that at the end. But first, I thought I should tell you a bit more about the story of Descartes' life, and then I'll go into some more detail as well about the discourse on method. So, René Descartes was born on the 31st of March 1596, the same year this college was founded. The village where he was born has since been renamed Descartes to acknowledge the extent of his influence. His father worked in Brittany as a magistrate, and this conferred upon the young Descartes a certain status. because lawyers could, by virtue of their profession, acquire the status of nobility. This is the noblesse de robe, or nobles of the gown, as opposed to the old military class of nobility, the noblesse d'épée, or nobles of the sword. And on both sides of his family, in fact, René was descended from successful and prosperous doctors and lawyers. Descartes tells us himself in his writings a few things about his childhood. He tells us that he was a pale and sickly child who suffered constantly from a cough. He tells us that he had a little playmate, a girl with a squint, and rather touchingly mentions that he has retained throughout his adult life a particular affection for people so afflicted. And I mention this anecdote just because it tells us something about Descartes recognising the importance of very early experience, bodily experience, if you like. Descartes was educated by a religious order, the Jesuits, who themselves found early experience to be so important that it dictated their pedagogical mission statement: show me a child of seven, and I will show you the man. He was sent away from home to attend a newly founded school, the Collège de la Flèche, which was to become one of the most famous schools in Europe. In common with other Jesuit schools, it had a very strict curriculum, taught as preparation for university degrees in theology or law or medicine. And Descartes would, in fact, go on to study law at the University of Poitiers. The headmaster of Descartes' school at the time that he was there was, in fact, related to Descartes' mother. And Descartes seems to have been allowed certain concessions. He was allowed to get up later than the other boys, and seems to have kept this habit throughout his life. In 1649, in his early 50s, he was offered patronage by Queen Christina of Sweden and appointed as her teacher of philosophy. And she requested that this instruction should commence daily at 5 a.m. And this, in combination, it must be said, with a bout of pneumonia, is widely supposed to be what killed him. So he died only a few months later, in February 1650. Now, he left behind a vast body of work, and I've put the most important ones there. Really, today, the most renowned, the Discours de la Méthode, the Discours on Method, are the Meditations, which are combined and summarised in the Principles of Philosophy, 1644. The Discours on Method, the source of our quotation, is autobiographical in tone. Descartes says he wants to paint his life, as it were, in a picture. So to tell you about that text is also, simultaneously, to go into more detail about his biography. And this is what he says about what he learnt at school in part one of the Discourse on Method. I think I'll just read the whole thing out. He says, "I did not cease to hold the school curriculum in esteem. I know that the Greek and Latin that are taught there are necessary for understanding the writings of the ancients, that fables stimulate the mind through their charm, that the memorable deeds recorded in history uplift it, and they help form our judgment when read in a discerning way, that reading good books is like engaging in conversation with the most cultivated minds of past centuries who had composed them, or rather, taking part in a well-conducted dialogue in which such minds reveal to us only the best of their thoughts, that oratory is incomparably powerful and beautiful, and that poetry possesses delightful delicacy and charm, that mathematics has very subtle techniques that can be of great use in satisfying curious minds, as well as in coming to the aid of all the arts and reducing human labour, that books on morals contain highly instructive teachings and exhortations to virtue, that theology charts our path to heaven, that philosophy provides us with the means of speaking plausibly about anything and impressing those who are less well instructed, that law, medicine and other disciplines bring to those who profess them riches and honours, and finally, that it is worthwhile to have studied all of these branches of knowledge, even the most superstitious and false, in order to learn their true value and avoid being deceived by them." Now, I don't know if you're getting a sense, as this is read out, of what is coming next, which is a great big however. But, however, he says, I don't know if this is going to resonate with the students in the room, but does any of it really teach you how to think? Philosophy on this account is just a way of learning how to impress. So Descartes in the Discourse on Method, from this point on, wants to change your relationship to your education, or lack of education. And in so doing, he wants to change your relationship to yourself. So he gives that account of what he had learned. And then he says, "I decided I had devoted enough time to all that." So instead of joining the legal profession, after studying law at Poitiers, he went off to join the army. He went to Holland in 1618 and joined the army of Prince Maurice of Nassau. And from there, he joined the army of Maximilian, the Duke of Bavaria in Germany. And it's not actually unusual in Descartes' time for young gentlemen of that class to do this, to move around like that. On the 10th of November, 1619, in Germany, and this is now part two of the Discourse on Method, he spent the whole day shut up in a small room heated by a stove in which I could converse with my own thoughts at leisure. And I don't know if you've heard references to Descartes' stove-heated room. This is it. He says he spent his time in the stove-heated room meditating on the foundations of a wonderful science. And this word foundations is vitally important to Descartes. It's a key metaphor in his work. He decides at this point that he wants to raise the entire edifice of existing knowledge to the ground. And Descartes also uses a different metaphor. He says that you have to think of knowledge as a tree, where the branches depend on the strength of the trunk, and the trunk depends on the strength of the roots. If you want to produce or attain any kind of knowledge at all, you have to start with the roots. So Descartes wants to start with the roots of the tree, or the foundations of the building, on which the rest of knowledge depends. And so he writes this. And through all the next 9 years, I did nothing but wander through the world, trying to be a spectator rather than an actor in all the dramas that had played out on that stage, and reflecting particularly in each matter on what might make it suspect and give occasion for error, I proceeded to eradicate from my mind all the mistakes that might earlier have crept into it. So this takes us up to the late 1620s. Now Descartes here, and throughout his work, is participating in a sort of diffuse movement which has come to be known as the scientific revolution, where previously accepted truth, the order of the world that had been set up by ancient thinkers such as Plato or Aristotle, is brought into question. Now, in the scholastic vision of the world, so in the vision of the world influenced by these ancient thinkers, the Earth is at the centre of the universe. The sun rises and sets, circling around the Earth every day. Material things are composed of elements, earth, air, fire, water, each of which has its proper place and a motion natural to it. So fire has a natural tendency to move upwards, earth has a natural tendency to move downwards, which is why smoke rises and a stone falls. The stone falls because it's returning to its proper place in the world. This is the view of the cosmos. This is the earth at the very centre. All of these circles here represent the motion of the planets around the earth at the centre. But scientific developments were showing that these assumptions, these assumptions about the world were false. So Copernicus, for example, in his we've got a picture of Copernicus as well. There he is. In his De Revolutionibus Orbium Coelestium, had demonstrated that it's not the Earth that's at the centre of the solar system, but the Sun. So it's not that the Sun moves around the Earth, but the other way around. We have moved from a geocentric view of the universe to a heliocentric one. And Descartes was part of a scientific community that was gradually accepted that what had counted as knowledge for thousands of years was not true at all, but false. Now, if we can be wrong about all that, how do we know what we can be right about? Is there any kind of knowledge or certainty that's up for grabs? And Descartes responds to the threat posed by this kind of scepticism. So what is this response? I mean, he's putting forward a method. So what is this method? Well, this is it. He writes that the first precept of this method was never to accept anything as true that I did not incontrovertibly know to be so. That is to say, carefully to avoid both prejudice and premature conclusions, and to include nothing in my judgments other than that which presented itself to my mind so clearly and distinctly that I would have no occasion to doubt it. Now, his method for attaining knowledge here perhaps seems paradoxical because, as you can see, Descartes does not reject doubt. In fact, he embraces doubt. And he embraces doubt because he refuses to accept anything that it is possible to doubt. And there's another good description of his method in the discussion around the meditations. He writes this. Suppose someone had a basket full of apples and was afraid that some of the apples might be rotten and wanted to remove them so that they did not spread their rottenness to others. How would he do this? Would he not first of all empty the basket altogether and then, examining the apples one after the other, put back only those he could see were unaffected and throw the rest away? So what Descartes does is he empties the whole basket of his beliefs and only puts back the ones he believes to be good. Now the meditations do this too. The meditator considers the basic principles that support his belief, tries to find arguments against them, and then replies to those arguments. And the first one of the apples in the basket, one of the basic beliefs that Descartes will examine, is the belief that our senses can be trusted. So consider some of the beliefs that you have right now. You believe that you're here in the hall, listening to this lecture. Or imagine that you're writing some meditations. Descartes' meditator believes, he says, that he is sitting in an armchair by a cozy fire, wearing a dressing gown, holding a piece of paper. Now you believe these things, you believe that you're here in this hall, because you trust your senses. And this is the basic principle, the apple that Descartes has taken out of the basket. Now whatever is sensed is, as it appears, to the senses. Now, are you going to put that back in the basket as a belief that you can trust, a principle that you can trust? Well, you can probably think of an example of something that shows that the senses are fallible. Okay, so in the meditations, Descartes will give a few examples. Our senses can deceive us when it comes to objects that are very small or in the distance, or look at a straight stick when it's half in water. It looks crooked. So from time to time, the senses deceive. We can't trust them. Well, that's all very well, but I might respond as the meditator does. I know that sometimes the senses deceive, but you're not telling me that I am not currently here giving this lecture. How could it be denied, writes Descartes' meditator, that these hands or this whole body are mine? And Descartes then raises a new class of skeptical objection in both the meditations and the discourse on method. What if you're dreaming? Well, there are a couple of people with their eyes shut, actually. So it's very, very cosy and warm in here. And in the meditations, he puts this as follows. How often, asleep at night, am I convinced of just such familiar events, that I am here in my dressing gown sitting by the fire, when in fact I am lying undressed in bed? I see plainly that there are never any sure signs by means of which being awake can be distinguished from being asleep. And here, of course, we have one of the most renowned arguments of all time. I have had dreams which I cannot distinguish from my waking experiences. So, the fact that I think I am experiencing something in a particular way does not guarantee at all that I am, in fact, experiencing it. I cannot know that I am not now dreaming, and nor can you. And what is implied, therefore, is that I can never know that I am not dreaming at any point. So the skeptical force of this argument is overwhelming. But Descartes is still not quite convinced, just as you now are pretty sure you can tell me that you're not dreaming. There are still some beliefs that escape the skepticism. So, for example, whether I am awake or asleep, 2 and 3 added together make 5. And a square has 4 sides. In the meditations, at this point, Descartes concludes, provisionally, that some beliefs in arithmetic and geometry contain something certain and indubitable. But in the discourse on method, Descartes puts it slightly differently. And here we are finally at our quotation. And this is a passage, actually, that I like to set for my first year faculty translation class. So there may be some people in the room who next term are in my first year faculty translation class, in which case I'm now just wantonly giving you the solution, so you can start writing this down. Anyway, here he is. Finally, considering that all the same thoughts which we have while awake can come to us while asleep without any one of them then being true, I resolve to pretend that everything that had ever entered my head was no more true than the illusions of my dreams. But immediately afterwards, I noted that while I was trying to think of things being false in this way, it was necessarily the case that I, who was thinking them, had to be something. And observing this truth, I am thinking, therefore I exist, was so secure and certain that it could not be shaken by any of the most extravagant suppositions of the skeptics. I judged that I could accept it without scruple as the first principle of the philosophy I was seeking. So here we are. Descartes has come up against the limits of his doubt because he's saying that doubting is a special case of thinking. So even if you are doubting that you are thinking, you are still thinking. And this is what we can call an incorrigible or a self-verifying proposition. So here, by way of illustration, are some examples of other propositions that are self-verifying. Here's one. I am talking to you right now. Here's another. I can speak some words of English. So if I assert to you that I can speak a few words of English, I can self-evidently speak at least some words of English. So here's another. I promise to stay for dinner tonight after my lecture. Now, if I say that I promise to stay for dinner, then I do, by that very statement, promise to stay for dinner. Now, I can promise that I'll come to dinner while simultaneously having absolutely no intention of staying for dinner, but that's a totally different matter. The act of stating it just is the promise. It does something. It's an example of what philosophers also sometimes call a performative speech act. So similarly, Descartes' statement, I am thinking, does thinking. You can't say that you're thinking without engaging in the basic act of thought. Just as you can't say that you promise something without transacting a promise. So Descartes has attained a basic truth, a basic principle. I cannot doubt that I am thinking, because doubting is also itself a kind of thinking. But how do we get from that to existence? So let's continue with our translation passage. Next, examining attentively what I was, I saw that I could pretend that I had no body, and that there was no world or place for me to be in, but that I could not, for all that, pretend that I did not exist. On the contrary, from the very fact that I thought of doubting the truth of other things, it followed incontrovertibly and certainly that I myself existed. So the point here is that while he is thinking, at the very moment he is thinking, he cannot pretend that he does not exist. I think, therefore I am. But linguists take note, I am thinking, therefore I exist, is much the better translation. I think, therefore I am, is the translation that has been handed down through history, but it's not the best translation, because the entire argument only holds if the I is thinking right at this very moment. So I think can just mean I generally believe, or I have the capacity to think, or I am a rational being. But Descartes is saying something different. He is saying that at the very moment you are thinking, you attain some kind of basic intuition about your existence. So Descartes' skeptical arguments have threatened everything but the knowledge provided in this statement, the cogito. He has had the clear and distinct intuition of his existence, and we have the beginnings of a path out of a skeptical mass of doubt. And before he turns to knowledge about the world, Descartes moves from this insight, the cogito, to another crucial matter, which I thought I really had to mention, and that is the existence of God. His doubt has been useful to him, but doubt is nonetheless an uncomfortable, imperfect state. So he writes this. As I thought about the fact that I was doubting, and that consequently my being was not altogether perfect, for I saw clearly that it was a greater perfection to know than to doubt, I decided to look for the source from which I had learned to think of something more perfect than I was myself. And I came to the incontrovertible realization that this must be from some nature that was in fact more perfect. Now, Descartes is going pretty fast here, so don't worry, it's not you, okay? It's Descartes. But he apparently makes the point in this quote that beyond the cogito, we can be sure about two things, that doubting is a kind of imperfection, and that we nonetheless have an idea of perfection. So where does this idea come from? The only possible cause is a perfect being. And here we move towards Descartes' proof of God's existence. In the third meditation, Descartes will express this idea as follows. He says, God, when he created me, inscribed this idea of perfection within me to serve, so to speak, as the mark by which the craftsman makes himself known in his handiwork. The whole force of the argument comes down to this, that I recognize that it cannot be that I should exist with the nature I possess, that is, having the idea of God within myself, unless, in reality, God also exists. So the meditator concludes that God exists. Now, in the Discourse on Method, and actually in Meditation 5 as well, Descartes adds this. Going back to the idea that I had had of a perfect being, I found that existence was part of that idea, in the same way, or even more incontrovertibly so, that it is intrinsic to the idea of a triangle, that its three angles equal two right angles, to that of a sphere, that all its parts are equidistant from its centre. Now, how do we know that the three angles of a triangle make up 180 degrees? Because the definition of a triangle is that it is a shape whose three angles add up to 180 degrees. How do we know that a perfect being exists? Because if something is perfect, it just means that it exists. So the discourse has brought us to what is known as the ontological argument for the existence of God. That's it. Another way of saying this is that it's an a priori argument. Perfection, in and of itself, just implies existence. Now, if you're finding this unconvincing, you're not alone. And I think it's impossible at this point, I've been going for about half an hour, so I think it's impossible at this point to go into any great detail about all the problems with these arguments, of which there are many. I'm not sure that there is a single possible objection to these arguments that wasn't already thought of by Descartes' contemporaries, who criticised them in the strongest possible terms. So all of the following points were hotly argued by Descartes' contemporaries. They said to Descartes, one, you claim to be following a new method, but really you're just arguing in exactly the same way as all the other philosophers, including the ones you despise. They say, two, you say that existence is part of perfection, that perfection implies existence. Why? No, it doesn't. And anyway, three, we do not have an idea of a perfect being. So Hobbes, for instance, said flatly that there is no idea of God in us. And four, perhaps most devastatingly of all, Descartes is held to be arguing in a circle. And this is the famous Cartesian circle. We need the clear and distinct intuition of the cogito before we can prove the existence of God. But Descartes also states that everything in us, including our clear and distinct ideas, comes from the perfect being, that is, God. So there seems to be a circle. These objections come immediately, and they also come later in Descartes' correspondence and in the controversies surrounding the publication of the Meditations in 1641, and they keep on coming. Now, at this point in the discourse, Descartes says, and we're now at the beginning of part 5 of the Discourse on Method, I would gladly go on, he says, and reveal the whole chain of the other truths that I deduced from these first ones. But in order to achieve this end, it would be necessary here for me to broach several questions that are controversial among learned men with whom I do not wish to fall out. So, what we have been hearing about here are the arguments that Descartes engaged in when he moved to the Netherlands in 1629. That's what we've been hearing about to this point. The Discourse on Method finally came out in 1637. So what happened in the meantime? Well, Descartes moved between Paris and the Netherlands, working on a book called Le Monde. He read Galileo, whose dialogue concerning the two chief world systems came out in 1632. And he engaged in experiments and observations, writing up thoughts on the digestion of food, the pulse, the distribution of nourishment, the five senses. At one point, he writes, "I am now dissecting the heads of various animals so that I can explain what imagination, memory, etc. consist in." We know from Descartes' surviving papers that accounts are given of the sun, the stars, the planets, comets, moon, and earth, weight and light, and the tides. But we have to turn to the papers that were left after Descartes' life, because this work was not published. And the closest people came to it in Descartes' lifetime was the account he gives in the next part of the Discourse on Method, part 5. And even there, he omits to mention various key details. So why did he not publish this work? And the answer, again, lies in what was happening around Descartes in the scientific revolution, and more particularly, what had happened to one man, Galileo. Galileo had been convinced by Copernicus's theory that the Earth is not at the centre of the universe, but instead moves around the sun. Now, according to the Roman Catholic Church, this could not accord with the literal truth of the Old Testament, and Galileo was convicted and imprisoned in 1633. And Descartes was frightened by this. And when Descartes finally does come to publish the Discourse, he limits himself to the more general method that we have seen of reaching the truth through the secure grounding of principles and then carefully checking conclusions by engaging in observations and experiments. So he appends to the Discourse as a substitute for the work he really wanted to publish, discourses on optics, on optical instruments, on meteorology, and on geometry. So it was actually quite a substantial volume when it was published. It wasn't the slim volume that this is, you know, these extra essays attached. In 1635, he had a little girl, a daughter, and she died in 1640, and this caused him great grief. In his later years, he turned to the moral philosophy, which he had always seen as the uppermost branches of the tree of philosophy. And this later work on the passions is very interesting. The way it ties in at various points with the earlier work that we've been looking at perhaps does more than anything else to question history's view of the dualist Descartes, who splits off mind from body and is only concerned with the sterile rationalism. This term dualism came in the 19th century. So, what conclusions can we draw from all this? One conclusion, I think, from what I've been saying today is that there are quite a lot of objections to Descartes' philosophy. And for accounts of Descartes, which really do, I think, as much as is humanly possible to bring out the force of the arguments, I'd recommend a few critics. I'll just put them up here. Bernard Williams, John Cottingham, Catherine Wilson, as well as the introductions to the editions of the Discourse and the Method, the Discourse on Method and the Meditations that I've been using today. So both the Oxford World Classics editions edited by Ian Plain and Michael Moriarty. So I'll just leave those up there. And another conclusion that we can draw, I will in fact lift directly from Ian Plain. He says in his edition of the Discourse, "While one must acknowledge that Descartes failed to achieve his philosophical goals and was wrong in many of his scientific claims, one cannot but admire the intellectual scope and ambition of his enterprise." So that's fair enough, I think. But there is another conclusion, I think, which is the one that sort of motivates me a bit more in my wider work on Descartes, and that is as follows, that in the way he expresses himself, in struggling with the writing down of mental states, Descartes has a lot in common with other 17th century authors, dramatists, and poets, and social observers, and theologians, who write so acutely about what it is possible to know about self-scrutiny and mortal doubt. Now, in 1637, the same year as the Discourse on Method was published, the dramatist Pierre Corneille wrote a play, Le Cid, which generated massive controversy. It was the literary controversy of its day, because it was decried as improbable. And it's also all about processes of truth-telling and what is true-seeming and what can acceptably be believed. And I think that Descartes, too, deals not just in logic, but in revelation and concealment and the path between the two. So there is a kind of drama there, or a poetics, if you like, and that is what I think is most interesting about it. But I've tried to give you a little bit of a general overview today, as I say, setting in context, so I hope that's helped.